This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump's impeachment trial quickly turned into a debate Wednesday over whether his former National Security Advisor John Bolton should be called as a witness. Congressman Adam Schiff, the lead House of Representatives manager prosecuting Mr. Trump, said there's no way to have a fair trial without witnesses. But with Mr. Trump's repeated denial of quid pro quo with Ukraine, military aid for the politically tinged investigation, Schiff said, it makes it all the more sense to call a witness who knows what happened. Florida Congresswoman Val Demings, a House impeachment manager, responds to a question about applying as much scrutiny to Mr. Trump's children as the Republicans are applying to Joe Biden's son, Hunter, who held a job in Ukraine.
Let us stay focused. This doesn't have anything to do with the president's children or the Biden's children. This is about the president's wrongdoing.
President Trump's defense attorney, Eric Hirschman, says that there were many reasons for President Trump to be concerned about corruption in Ukraine in relation to the job held by Hunter Biden.
A corrupt Ukrainian oligarch who was paying our vice president's son and his son's business partner millions of dollars for no apparent legitimate reason, while his father was overseeing our country's relationship with Ukraine, merit any public inquiry, investigation, or interest?
The question and answer process will continue Thursday as well before the chamber proceeds to a four-hour debate on witnesses Friday. President Trump declared an end to what he termed the nightmare North America Free Trade Agreement during a signing ceremony on the White House lawn Wednesday. He inked his name on the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Canada is yet to ratify the pact. That process could take months, with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau facing rounds of deal-making with political rivals. This is VOA News. More than 170 people have died from the coronavirus, and the number of confirmed cases has exceeded 6,000. Now the World Health Organization says it will decide Thursday whether to reconsider its decision to not declare a global health emergency and whether the coronavirus outbreak is a global health threat. More from VOA's Lisa Schlein.
Executive Director of WHO Health Emergencies Program, Michael Ryan, says the decision to reconvene the emergency committee is based on the evidence of an increasing number of cases and also upon the human-to-human transmission that has occurred outside of China. Ryan says these developments and the evolution of the outbreak are spurring China and other countries into action.
But the whole world needs to be on alert now. The whole world needs to take action and be ready for any cases that come, either from the original epicenter or from other epicenters that become established.
WHO says the Chinese response to the new coronavirus has been extraordinary. It praises the transparency and willingness of the government to share vital information and provide assistance to foreign countries grappling with the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has warned that the United States will only pass information across what he termed trusted networks, and he criticized close ally Britain over its decision to allow the Chinese firm Huawei to build parts of the country's 5G mobile network. Speaking to reporters en route to London Wednesday, where he is due to meet Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, the Secretary Pompeo said that putting Huawei into the British system creates a real risk. He also said that described Huawei as an extension of China's Communist Party that is obligated to hand over information to the party, adding that the Trump administration will evaluate Britain's decision. Vanessa Bryant releases a statement expressing the family's sorrow. AP correspondent Mike Rossia.
Vanessa Bryant has released her first public statement since the helicopter crash that killed her husband Kobe Bryant, 13-year-old daughter Gianna, and seven others. Vanessa Bryant writes on Instagram, "We are completely devastated by the sudden loss of my adoring husband Kobe, the amazing father of our children, and my beautiful, sweet Gianna, a loving, thoughtful, and wonderful daughter and amazing sister to Natalia, Bianca, and Capri. We are also devastated for the families who lost their loved ones on Sunday, and we share in their grief intimately." Vanessa Bryant also announced the formation of a fund to help the other families affected by the crash. I'm Mike Gracia.
More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. What will be the likely economic impact on Africa of the China coronavirus?
For example, a country like Nigeria is heavily dependent on the price of oil. Anything that reduces transportation and travel in China, that reduces the demand for oil for business activity, is going to push that price down and directly impact the Nigerian economy.
We'll also look at alert levels in the West Africa region, home to thousands of Chinese nationals. The UN has again appealed for dialogue in Guinea's ongoing political crisis. An unexplained gas shortage has hit Liberia, and Zimbabwe opposition leader Nelson Chamisa is in South Africa.
The agenda and mission we have come here for is to make sure that we create a platform for the resolution of the issues in Zimbabwe. We can't be having the situation we are having in Zimbabwe.
At the same time, the Mnangagwa government denies that there is a crisis in Zimbabwe, and Botswana's opposition coalition has suffered a setback in its bid to overturn last October's general election results. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. China's growing coronavirus epidemic has already spread well beyond its borders, and while the epidemic is primarily a health and humanitarian crisis, its impact also extends to China's economy, which is connected as never before to emerging markets in the developing world, including Africa. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with economist Joseph Foudy of New York University, where he teaches courses on emerging markets and Asian economies.
For countries that trade with China, it means, you know, demand for their goods is likely to be down. Remember, China is the largest importer in the world of almost every major commodity, be that cement, copper, or just a range of goods produced and exported around the world.
What about the effect of all this on the developing world in Southeast Asia, Latin America, and especially Africa, where this interview is being broadcast?
So an enormous amount of the output of emerging markets around the world today is exports, particularly of raw materials, metals, other commodities, food, that goes to China. And so anytime we expect a slowdown in Chinese growth, that's going to directly affect the quantities of exports and the prices from those countries. A lot of these countries are also destinations for Chinese investment, particularly under the One Belt, One Road. Those are long-run investments, and I don't expect them to be impacted. But the timing of those investments may get put off in future. You're going to see fewer Chinese traveling abroad, fewer international business people traveling to China over the next couple of months. And that means lots of projects that might have gotten started later in the year will be delayed potentially 6 months or even a year.
What's an example of an actual impact that you envision may be in store in Africa?
A direct impact will be on the prices of the goods they're selling. So, for example, a country like Nigeria is heavily dependent on the price of oil. Anything that reduces transportation and travel in China, that reduces the demand for oil for business activity, is going to push that price down and directly impact the Nigerian economy. In the other direction, there are many Chinese companies looking to invest across Africa. And while that investment's going to continue in the long run, you could imagine that there's going to be a pause for the next 6 months on many of those projects as fewer people travel internationally and as Chinese companies and Chinese government officials take a wait-and-see approach.
That was New York University economics professor Joseph Foudy. He spoke with viewers Adam Phillips in New York. The coronavirus appears to be spreading rapidly, and governments around the world are sounding the alarm. West Africa is home to thousands of Chinese nationals, and officials there are standing guard after a suspected case was reported in Ivory Coast. Annika Hamishlar reports from Dakar.
West Africa is no stranger to deadly epidemics. During the 2014 to 2016 Ebola outbreak, more than 11,000 people lost their lives. But by some measures, the disease has made the region stronger. When reports about the coronavirus began surfacing, some government officials were quick to respond. Dr. Ousmane Gaye is the director of the National Service for Education and Health Information with Senegal's Ministry of Health. He says anytime an epidemic outbreak occurs that has the potential to spread to Senegal, the government forms a national committee comprised of the ministries of health, livestock, environment, and others. Working together, the ministers have created a toll-free emergency number that residents can dial in the event of suspected infection. They've broadcast announcements via TV and radio to inform people what to do if they exhibit symptoms. And they've installed thermal cameras at the shipping port and airport that can detect if a traveler has a temperature. As of Wednesday, no cases of coronavirus in West Africa had been confirmed. However, one suspected case in Ivory Coast was under investigation. Given West Africa's ties to China, the region is at a disadvantage, according to Dr. Michel Yao, a program manager for emergency response for the World Health Organization in Africa.
There is an increased partnership between African countries and China. So we have many people in business traveling between two countries. Africans going to import goods from China, and also Chinese implementing business in Africa.
Yao said countries can best protect the residents by closely monitoring their ports of entry. Many West Africans share Yao's concern. Dakar resident Maya Jope was getting her hair braided in the city's Ngor neighborhood on Wednesday. She said, though the situation is nothing like what she experienced during the Ebola outbreak, she's still worried. She says some Senegalese have family in China who are posting on social media that they can no longer leave their homes. If they return to Senegal without knowing whether they have the virus, they could transmit it. Everyone is concerned. Sadio Mane, a cook at a creperie next door, who's named after the famed Senegalese soccer champion, said he too was worried. Even if it's in China, he says, people are always traveling left and right, so that concerns them too. As the number of those infected rises each day, so does the concern the disease will reach the shores of West Africa. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar.
The special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel, Mohamed Ibn Chambers, says the United Nations is trying to maintain peace and stability in the region while respecting national constitutional provisions. This comes as some reports say Guinea's economy is crumbling after months of mass protest against President Alpha Condé's alleged attempt to change the constitution and seek another term. On Wednesday, Guinean religious leaders appealed to the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, the FNDC, the alliance of opposition groups behind the protest, to suspend their demonstration. The religious group also asked the Guinean government to suspend the February 16 parliamentary election and for both sides to dialogue. Chambers says there is need for dialogue among all Guineans.
The UN position has been clear from the beginning. We urge all Guinean stakeholders, the political parties, civil society, of course the authorities, the government, to make every effort to create a conducive environment and atmosphere for dialogue. Dialogue to address issues that are dividing Guineans, which now is resulting in the street confrontations that we have been witnessing on the part of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution and security forces.
On Wednesday, religious leaders in Guinea presented a statement to the FNDC, as well as the government of Guinea, calling on the FNDC to suspend street demonstration and President Alpha Condé, the government, to suspend the process towards election. What do you make of that?
We encourage Guinean opinion leaders, public leaders, traditional religious leaders to play a role in appeasing the situation, in calling for calm and restraint on all sides, and calling for dialogue. And we would like to see them even take more of a center stage, perhaps create a platform to bring all Guinean stakeholders to be able to come around and talk about the issues that divide them. I'm sure that they will find that there are many more things that unite them as Guinean people than they divide them. We have some concerns also relating to increasing ethnic tensions in Guinea.
The opposition have accused the government of initiating this ethnic violence, because if you talk to the opposition, they tell you that the people who have died so far during these protests have been people who are not members of President Alpha Condé's ethnic group. I wonder if you heard that from other sources.
That is something that we have been hearing for some time, and it's naturally of concern. And that's why during my visit, this issue was raised at the highest level and with all the different stakeholders. that Guinea is a country where different ethnic groups have lived together harmoniously. And that's another reason why the UN is particularly worried that Guinea does not slip into conflict and instability.
You mentioned the parliamentary elections that are supposed to take place in February. One of the concerns the opposition has been raising with us is that the national registry necessary for this election has been corrupted. The UN is encouraging that this election should take place under a free and fair atmosphere. Can they really take place in February?
I'm not in a position to comment on that because the UN has not been invited to support the electoral process, so we do not have any experts working in Guinea. As I told you, the organization, the National Organization of Francophonie, OEF, which has a mission there. We support their effort to address legitimate concerns that the opposition and others may have, so that at the end of the day, you will have an electoral list, for instance, that the population and all political actors will have confidence in.
At the center of all this dispute, the protests and everything, is the argument made by the opposition that President Alpha Condé is trying to change the constitution to remain in power. Have you come around discussing this during your meetings with both the opposition and the president?
In our position as UN, what we can do and what we do is to ask for respect for the constitution of each country.
Thank you very much, sir. We are always happy to speak with you.
Thank you, Mr. Bhatti. Always a pleasure.
Mohamed Ibn Chambers is the special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel. He was speaking with us from Dakar, Senegal. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bhatti in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 30. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. For nearly a week now, Liberians have been experiencing an unexplained shortage of gasoline in the country, resulting in long queues at filling stations across the country. Some retailers have also tripled the price of the commodity, which has created inconveniences for the citizens. As Moses Gazier will report from Monrovia, the Liberian government says it is making efforts to resolve the crisis.
There is a long queue at this local filling station, located less than a mile from President George Weah's home. In the line are over 50 cars, dozens of motorcycles and tricycles, most of whom are doing business. Kelvin Goa, a taxi driver, has been cycling from one filling station to another since morning, and he is not closer to getting gas.
I've been here since early 5 o'clock this morning. I went to petrol tree and I want to get gasoline. So now I total here to try again since they have now grown traffic. If I can get gas today, then by tomorrow I'll start my running.
Like Kelvin Jaswayene, another taxi driver is also frustrated by the fact that he is unable to do business because of gas shortage.
I've been here and I'm catching difficulties. This is only my source of income. This is only where I survive without my family. And I'm getting it difficult to go out to survive. So it's really, really burning to me.
David Miller was one of the lucky few to get gasoline. He has parked his car during the last 4 days.
The past 3 to 4 days, my car has been parking. So having gas in my car today, I'm very happy because I've been walking, looking for a car on the street to go to work.
At first, the Liberia Petroleum Refining Company denied the shortage, claiming there was sufficient gasoline in the country. The LPRC also threatened to go after vendors who it said were creating artificial shortage. Commerce Minister Wilson Tappet told local media that the situation has become an embarrassment for the government.
Oh, the state is a very serious matter. We realize there is a problem. As of the week of January 24, we have about 4.4 million of gallons of PMS, and that is supposed to give us about 26 days of supply, and that was adequate. But when we got to realize the actual quantity in the tanks at the various storage facilities was significantly less than that.
He said a ship containing about 2,700 metric tons of gasoline, enough for 8 days, of supply was expected yesterday, Wednesday. According to Minister Tappet, the current shortage is expected to last about a week.
For clearing purpose, I would say between now and the weekend, or let's say Monday or Tuesday, we should be able to clear. Again, it depends on the number of ships that will be coming in. But as we speak, this ministry, with the support of the president, is taking steps, working with LPRC to bring additional quantity.
Meanwhile, hundreds of taxi drivers are expected to go for days or even a week without being able to provide for their families due to the gas shortage. Commuters will also continue to be stranded due to the absence of commercial vehicles. Moses Gazo, VOA News, Monrovia.
Zimbabwe opposition leader Nelson Chamisa is in South Africa on a diplomatic offensive to pressure President Cyril Ramaphosa to intervene in Zimbabwe's ongoing political crisis and avert a further economic decline. Chamisa, the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, has made several appeals to Ramaphosa to facilitate dialogue between him and President Mnangagwa. Chamisa has challenged Mnangagwa's legitimacy and accused Mnangagwa of stealing the 2018 election. Chamisa tells Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service that he wants Pretoria to intervene because the political temperature in Zimbabwe is rising.
The agenda and mission we have come here for is to make sure that we create a platform for the resolution of the issues in Zimbabwe. We create an opportunity and a solidarity for Zimbabweans in the diaspora and also friends and partners on the African continent within the region of SADC to come together with us to find a common solution and an answer to our problem so that we are able to move forward. That is what we are working on.
Any plans to meet President Ramaphosa or former President Thabo Mbeki?
I will not disclose whom I'm meeting, but I can tell you that we will be meeting those who matter in helping us to help ourselves. The Zimbabwean solution is going to come from Zimbabwe. So we need Zimbabweans to come together, but be helped by our neighbors, be helped by those who are supposed to help us to move the country forward, to deal with our own issues. We can't be having the situation we are having in Zimbabwe. A burning Zimbabwe will set ablaze the entire Sub-Saharan region and the entire continent. We can't have a successful South Africa without a thriving Zimbabwe. We can't have a prosperous Sub-Saharan Botswana, Mozambique, Malawi, Zambia, Namibia, even South Africa, without having Zimbabwe being lifted.
But President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his inner circle are saying that there is no need for regional intervention, and they are saying that there are discussions going on under the banner of the so-called Pollard.
Well, I don't know what discussions are taking place. Pollard is not a platform I'm willing to engage in. I know that those who are there are affiliates of Mr. Mnangagwa. We are talking about dialogue of people who are not in agreement. Dialogue can be between people who are of the same mind. So if Mr. Mnangagwa and those people whom he's meeting are in agreement, there's no problem. We need to agree because we are disagreeing. And in order for us to agree, there has to be some kind of mediation. We need a mediator, a facilitation, we need a facilitator, and an interlocutor, a person who is able to bring us together. I have said, in any negotiation, in any situation where there has to be a relationship of parties that way, that are known to each other, there has to be somebody who is helping.
And also, they are saying that SADC will only intervene if there is no crisis, and they are alleging that there is no crisis at all in Zimbabwe.
Whoever claims that there is no crisis in Zimbabwe must be living on another planet, or it's another Zimbabwe that we do not know.
That was Zimbabwe opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. He was speaking from Johannesburg, South Africa, with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service. Reacting to opposition leader Nelson Chamisa's regional initiative, ruling ZANU-PF Party Secretary for Administration Paul Magwana says there is no crisis in Zimbabwe that calls for regional intervention.
Our president has told him point blank that there is a program in place right now which we call Pollard. He is free to join Pollard, which is a grouping of all the political parties in the country, to discuss any political challenges we have in the country. So we do not see the reason why he has to travel all the way to other countries of South Africa.
But some political analysts, Mr. Magwana, are arguing that it appears Pollard has suffered a stillbirth.
No, we are actually engaging even on constitutional reforms under Pollard. We have a clear program under Pollard. You only need to come and see what Pollard is doing in order for you to believe it. But there's a lot of problems happening under Pollard.
But what is wrong with regional intervention, seeing that the economic and political crisis in Zimbabwe seems to be worsening?
We do not have a crisis. We have economic challenges, but we do not have a crisis. I disagree that there's a crisis. We have economic challenges which we are addressing as a country. And there is no country which does not have its own challenges either. The reason why we're given 5 years to run this country is to resolve any challenges we have within the period of 5 years. And we are still within that period where we are addressing all the economic and political challenges in our country.
Paul Magwana is the Secretary for Administration for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party. He was speaking from Harare with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe's service. Botswana's opposition coalition has suffered a blow in its bid to have last October's general election results overturned. On Wednesday, the Southern African Nations Court of Appeal dismissed the opposition's election challenge, which all but ends their victory hopes. Kunduzi Dube reports from Habaroni, Botswana.
The opposition coalition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, went to court in December seeking to overturn last year's general election results. But the country's High Court dismissed the first challenge on a technicality. The UDC had won 15 seats in the 57-member National Assembly, but argued the process was fraught with irregularities. The ruling Botswana Democratic Party, BDP, took 38 seats in the National Assembly, while smaller parties shared the remaining four. After their High Court loss, the opposition sought the intervention of the Supreme Court. But on Wednesday, the Court of Appeal's full bench dismissed the appeal. Justice Kirby, speaking on behalf of a 5-member panel, said the Court of Appeal, the highest in the land, had no jurisdiction to hear the petitions. The state lawyer, Andrew Redding, said the issue has been laid to rest.
Once a petition is brought, it is dealt with, it is dismissed, that has been determined. Until a new petition is brought, perhaps there may be an opportunity, time may still exist, to bring a new petition. But for the time that the petition has been dismissed, the dispute in relation to the validity of the election is over.
UDC spokesperson Moeti Mwasa refused to comment on the court's ruling. He said his party will analyze the judgment first. The ruling BDP spokesperson Banks Kinsey asked the opposition to accept the court verdict in order to allow the country to move forward. President Mokgweetsi Masisi this week told the media there was no distraction in the running of the government, despite the electoral challenges.
We have always been addicted to the rule of law. And so for every citizen, they know that if you have a challenge, if you have a dispute, you go to the courts of law, it'll be settled. So when matters are before the courts, life goes on.
President Masisi will now breathe much easier after Wednesday's ruling. Regional bloc, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, had delayed releasing a report on the Botswana election pending the outcome of the court process. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The coronavirus appears to be spreading rapidly, and governments around the world are sounding the alarm. West Africa is home to thousands of Chinese nationals, and officials there are standing guard after a suspected case was reported in Ivory Coast. The special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel, Mohamed Ibn Chambas, said the United Nations is trying to maintain peace and stability in the region while respecting national constitutional provisions. And Zimbabwe's opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa, is in South Africa on the diplomatic offensive to pressure President Cyril Ramaphosa to intervene in Zimbabwe's ongoing political crisis and avert a further economic decline. Chamisa, the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change, has made several appeals to Ramaphosa to facilitate dialogue between him and President Mnangagwa. That is it for this Thursday, January 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the Great Lakes region has a turbulent history marked by conflict at the expense of its citizens. Human rights in the Great Lakes region on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Rock and roll, America's finest export.
Our culture and music of today are permanently indebted to the pioneers who trailblazed this musical tradition. Listen to Border Crossings on February 6th to hear rock's greatest musicians like Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly, and Elvis Presley, only on The Voice of America.